Hi, this is Phil Everly.
Hi, this is Richard Kincaid.
This is Frank Beard.
And Billy Gibbons.
And Dusty Hill.
And on behalf of ZZ Top, we'd like to wish all our friends a fine holiday season.
I'd like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas.
This is Steve Winwood. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Happy Holidays.
We'll have a Merry Christmas
and a funky New Year.
You're listening to the Sounds of Christmas podcast.
Hi, I'm Ken Kessler, and welcome to the Sounds of Christmas podcast. If you're new to this podcast, I want to start by saying thanks for joining us. If you're not new, welcome back. Either way, I'm glad you're here. Now, to avoid any confusion, I want to start off by saying there won't be any music played here. This is a place for conversation. I'll talk about Christmas music and some related topics, sometimes by myself and sometimes with guests. If you're looking for music, just go to soundsofchristmas.com and click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page. We play the best variety of Christmas music all year long. Well, except in October, when we play the best variety of Halloween music. I'm very excited to have today's guest on the Sounds of Christmas podcast. And I love, it's Aubrey Logan, and I love your bio on Twitter. Your friendly neighborhood singer, songwriter, trombonist.
Oh my goodness. That's wonderful of you to look at. I really appreciate it. I may have just changed it literally today to match my Instagram bio, which says jazz-ish, depending on who you ask, singer, trombone player, songwriter, total ham.
You know, it was funny. I was just looking around the last few days to see if there was anything new that I should make sure that I ask you about. And I was also wondering, because you're nobody is just one thing. So I was looking for a way to introduce you. And then I saw, well, you did it yourself. Singer, songwriter, trombonist. Terrific.
That's great.
I have to ask you, how the trombone, how did you start with that?
When I was 12 years old, I had a singing background already from having done some child roles in musical theater, where I'm from in the Seattle area. And my mom is a choir director, you know, retired choir director. My dad was a band director, and yes, they had a baby. And so I couldn't really get away from the music or the music education, because there were kids coming in and out of our house all the time. Even though I was an only child, I had like a lot of brothers and sisters kind of, you know, that were students of my parents. So as they, as I aged out of certain child roles, I was going back to school more full time, you know, in middle school, and I wanted to be with my friends in the band. And I wasn't in band because I didn't play a wind instrument. And my mom, who was the choir director at the school at the time, asked the band director, because I was not going to be in choir. There was no way I was going to be in my mom's class. She asked the band director if I could join the band, and her colleague, and he said, yes, of course. And, we just let nepotism do its thing, because he said, what instrument does she play? And mom said, well, she doesn't play one. But I was late. I was in the seventh grade, and they all started band in like the fifth grade. And I didn't have any wind instrument, you know, in my background at all. And I didn't play any percussion. I read music. I played some piano, but I didn't, you know how to make a sound on anything. And my dad was a trumpet player. He brought home a few instruments from the school he was the principal at the time. And he brought home a French horn, a saxophone, a flute. He had his trumpet, and he brought home a trombone. And I kind of tried them all out. And the trombone on that particular day, for some reason, I could make a sound on it. And I had some frame of reference for it because my parents listened to Chicago and James Brown and big band music all the time. They listened to jazz all the time and classical music, but I wanted to play something that would be in the jazz band. And I didn't see violins in the jazz band, although we now know that's fine, or flutes, but we now know, you got to play jazz flute if you play saxophone. But that was how I got started on the trombone. The band director was gracious enough to let me join in late, and I was pretty obsessed with it, and kind of wanted to catch up as quickly as I could. So that's the story. And I just didn't stop singing. So that's how that happened.
You sang all mm-hmm. along.
Yeah.
And then you picked up the trombone. When did mm-hmm. scatting enter the picture?
When I picked up the trombone. Yeah, because scatting is improvising on a horn. except with your face, with your voice. So, yeah, I mean, I scatting should be imitating a horn player. That's what it is. That's what Louis Armstrong did and Ella Fitzgerald did. And I mean, Louis Armstrong didn't have to imitate a horn player because he was one. And then Ella Fitzgerald was just imitating horn players. And, you know, Pam Lambert, Hendrix and Ross, you even put, you know, lyrics on it, called it vocalese. So, yeah, it sort of was a natural progression of playing a wind instrument and learning how to improvise on that, which I was taught to do, you know, by reading chord scales and arpeggios and learning how to improvise with my trombone.
And all of that is on, you'll hear all of that on Aubrey's Christmas album. And yes, and we'll get to that in a second, but it was just, not everybody does that. Not anymore. It sure used to be much more common.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe Mel Torme was sort of the last of the big time scatters.
So sure, in the mainstream, I suppose so. I mean, now we have Kurt Elling doing it all the time, and we have, it's very, very strong in the colleges. It's strong in the high schools even. I've been going to a lot of schools lately. It's encouraging to see. And you know, scatting needs to come to an end at some point. Like, the best part of a scat solo is when it's over. But you know, less is more. It's always, leave them wanting, you want them wanting more, not less. I also grew up listening to Al Jarreau, and he was even later than Mel Torme. And he made something traditionally that was a swing tradition into something super funky. And I couldn't get away from hearing that because of my parents too. They just had him on all the time. But yeah, it's definitely, I'm a little bit of a weirdo these days, still doing that.
Yeah, I think it, you know, it's, you're good at it. And
thank
there
you.
Are a lot of people who try to do that and they shouldn't.
You know, I'll say, I'll it's not necessary to scat sing to convey an emotion or a musical thought. It's certainly not necessary, but it is. I have a bag of tricks and it's in there, so I pull it out, hopefully sparingly enough.
Now, as I was looking up different things about you, I thought, okay, 2009, very interesting year. On the one hand, Audience Choice Award and Jury's First Place Award at the Schirmantro Jazz Festival in Switzerland. Wow, that sounds
amazing.
That
was kind of the year I grew up. That was the year I grew up.
There's that on the one hand, sure. And then there's American Idol on the other hand.
Yeah, that same year I got rejected right before the Montreux Jazz Festival happened.
How did you get into the Montreux Jazz Festival? Was this just something that anybody, was this a college thing? Was this something that
they, they had an open vocal competition, piano competition, and guitar competition, if I recall. They may even have more now. At the time, well, it might just be that. And so you were just required, you didn't have to be a student. You just had to be like under 30 or something, or under 35 or something. And when I was 17, I sent in my first audition tape. I got in to the semifinals, I guess, you know, which means you go. But I couldn't go because Berklee College of Music had asked me that year to do a summer camp. And I knew if I did the summer camp, I would have a chance at a full ride to school. So it was like, go to Montreux or get a full ride. And my mom's like, you're going to Berklee College of Music camp. Sorry. And then fast forward to 2009, I auditioned again, and I was a Berklee student at the time. You didn't have to be a college student to go. You could just be anywhere in the world. And I think there were two Americans that year. A friend of mine, Charles, was in it that year. And yeah, you sent in a tape. You sent, you know, a recording of like three songs, and that's how they chose me to go. And then you went and performed with the band. I mean, the bandstand had Patrice Rushen on it, and that's how I met her and started working with her. And then I showed up with my arrangements because I'm thinking I have to be prepared for this. I can't just show up and wing this. I've never really been one to wing things, even though I'm even though I play improvisational music. I'm not a wing it kind of person. I'm more the like show business jazz artist than I am the like improvise only jazz artist, I guess. So I showed up with my charts and did my little 3-song show, and there you have it.
Did I read this right? And I think it's on your website that you've worked with Quincy Jones.
I was on a recording with Nikki Yanofsky, and I played trombone on that, sang on that. That was one of the first gigs I ever had after I moved to LA. Quincy was sitting there producing at Capitol Records.
Burt Bacharach?
Yeah, he came to Berklee College of Music when I was a student there, and he was featured on a show we were doing. And that story was funny because I was asked to be a part of the show to tribute him. And I told the musical director, of course I will. Of course I will. What can I sing? Walk on by, say a little prayer. What hit can I do? And he's like, oh, you're going to do Promises, Promises. And I'm thinking, that's in 7. I'm not doing that. Nobody knows that. Well, of course they do, because it's great. But I did it because he said, you know, everybody else here is going to do the hits, but you're going to do the jazzier one. So I did Promises, Promises. And you know what? I was so thankful to the musical director at the end, because Burt Bacharach, after he had played, he came up and said, I'm so happy you did that. And he said it right in front of the musical director too. You know, so nice. It was a big, I told you so kind of moment.
Nice. Smokey Robinson.
Yeah, he was on something that I was on. I was singing backup on. You know, you're in LA long enough, and name dropping becomes just a part of your life, I suppose.
Well, let's I guess fast forward to Postmodern Jukebox. Mm-hmm. You were now Scott Bradley wasn't he in New England somewhere?
Well, he started he's from Connecticut, if I recall. And he started the band in New York, but he moved to LA just before I did.
Okay.
And you're in LA long enough, Scott Bradley calls. that is quite literally what happened. I had been making some videos myself that were covers of pop songs, and they weren't as like period drama as Scott's. They weren't as specific. I mean, he really liked, especially then. He's looser about it now, but especially then, he really wanted things to sound like the 40s. Like very specific. And he wanted you to look like it. And his manager found my number somehow. And then I did that Bad Blood video with them. And then I did a bunch of tours with them. And now we're very good friends. And I've made some of the best friends of my life through that group. And very thankful to Scott.
It's funny. When I saw that you had been part of the Scott's Postmodern Jukebox, it had occurred to me that I remembered seeing a video, and I couldn't remember what the song was, but I remembered seeing a video years ago where there was a woman singing, and a couple minutes in it, they threw a trombone to her.
That was Scott's idea, and I was so frightened, but I'm like, listen, okay, you're buying me a new one if it breaks. Actually, that might have been his assistant's idea. That might have been Rook. Rook, if you're listening to this, I think that was because he was the one that had to actually throw it to me, because Scott was in the video and Rook was off camera. And it was that day that I decided to start, speaking of improv, it was that day that I started to decide to plan the first like 5 notes of my trombone solo.
From there, do you call it going solo?
I don't know. I never went solo. I was already doing my own songwriting and my own shows. So I never, I guess you got to call it something for people to understand. But I never, there was never a moment I would say that, you know, delineated that.
Yeah, if Scott called you tomorrow, you would probably go and do something with him.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would definitely talk about, I'm going to make another video with him soon for sure. It's like a Postmodern Jukebox is kind of like SNL for musicians. It's not a band. It's just a bunch of silly musicians like us going, you know, singers primarily, front people going in and out of the band. And it's a revolving door, you know, and we're all kind of in this family now.
At what point did Pity Party happen?
I wrote Pity Party for my first, well, for all intents and purposes, solo album. The album was called Impossible. And I wrote, I wrote, why did I write Pity Party? Well, because I was feeling sad about myself. I wrote it about all the struggles of being an independent artist, I suppose. And I have to work really hard to get people to come to my shows and to get the word out and to do social media and to do interviews. And I thought I could just play music and call it good. And I wrote Pity Party for fun. But you know, I wrote it as a country song. My pity party's over, and I'm sorry it went so long. And then it turned into jazz. You know, I couldn't. We were too far down the jazz. The we were pointing over turn in this whole jazz artist like thing that I had to make it swing. So pity party's over, and I'm sorry it went so long. You know, and there it was. And then it was time to enter some of my original songs into the timing was such that I could enter it into the American Songwriting Competition, I think is what it was. And it had categories. That competition had categories. It had pop and had folk and it had Americana and it had jazz. And I'm like, shoot, okay. Since when does a songwriter get to submit a jazz tune? Because most of the time they're instrumental and most of the time, you know, and I wrote lyrics and I submitted it and it won the jazz category.
Wow.
Right around the time I released that album. So I'm very thankful for that.
Wow. Now, a lot of artists, when they sort of get out on their own, they do a lot of covers. And it is amazing to me the variety of artists that you have covered, from Barbara Streisand to Sonny and Cher, Carole King, Hall & Oates, Wham, the Doobie Brothers, Macklemore, Michael Jackson, Bruno Mars, MC Hammer, and Jimi Hendrix. And it's like, I would almost say which one of these things doesn't belong here, but they're all so diverse. Jimi Hendrix seems to really stick out to me. How did you come to that?
Well, a song is a song is a song. So it doesn't really matter what genre it is or what era it's from. If the lyrics are something I can resonate with, whether that's something very heartfelt and sad or something just about having a party, it's on the drawing board. It's there. It's welcome to the brainstorm whiteboard for me. It doesn't, we all have the same 12 notes. We all have that in common, and you can play the same drum beat or you can switch it up a little bit. So for me, it doesn't really, I don't care very much when it comes to choosing a cover, what place or time the artist is from, and nor even really what they sound like, as long as they sound good. As far as the Jimi Hendrix was concerned, that was a collaboration I did with Sarah Reich, and she was tap dancing on it. And I said, I'm doing an album called Your Mom's Favorite Songs. So we need something from the 70s that you want to tap dance on. And it needs to be really fast because you're going to tap dance, and we need to impress people because this is the internet. So we can't do anything pretty. We have to do something fast and furious. And she said, Fire by Jimi Hendrix. So that was her. That one was her idea, in fact.
One of the things that I really love about Christmas music is that you can have this sort of array of artists and nobody says anything. Nobody complains.
Right.
But, you know, traditional radio and most record labels want to put you in a box. And if you're doing the Hall & Oates, then that's where you need to stay in that lane. And the truth is, we all love lots of different kinds of music, and we're all over the map. And Christmas seems to be a genre of music where that's allowed. Might be the only one left where that's allowed.
It's the common thread of taking music from various eras and traditions and putting them together. That's for sure.
There are a lot of artists who will decide, well, I guess I need to put out a Christmas song. And they'll, you know, and it sounds like they had 5 minutes of studio time left, and they knock out Jingle Bell Rock, which is a song I pick on a lot. And I apologize to everybody who's listening.
I will never, I never say never, but I'll never do that one.
but one of the things that I always look for, because with the Sounds of Christmas station, I get hundreds of songs sent to me every year.
Sure.
And the bar I set is, do I believe it? when they're singing it? Does it sound like I've got a few minutes of studio time and I'm going to knock this out? Or does it, do I believe it? And you put out Blue Christmas a few years ago, and wow, either you're just really good at conveying that sort of emotion or you felt it. But when I listen to you do Blue Christmas, I believe it. There are people who will do that song and you can almost see a smirk on their face and they a sort of wink and they'll do this song and they're having a good time. And that's not what Blue Christmas is about. And you made me believe that that was true, that you were telling
the truth. I'm really glad. Thank you. I'm really glad.
You're very welcome.
I arranged every song on that album pretty carefully. And, you know, there, when we go to the studio, that's the day we do record it live. Like the band's all in one room. Blue Christmas, we piecemealed together a little bit because it had a more of a pop sound to it, but, recorded a lot, you know, the piano player and I at least did everything together so we could connect. And, but that's after I've spent weeks and hours and hours and hours alone in a room arranging everything and writing it all down first. And then I bring it to, I'm very blessed to like the best players ever and say, hey guys, turn on the record button and play your heart out, please. And really, I have a band that plays their heart out. And I've always worked with people like that in LA and Nashville and Austin now and in New York and London. If it weren't for them, how would I get the help getting that emotion out I appreciate that compliment because it does mean a lot to me that you feel what I'm feeling when I do these arrangements, whether they're covers or originals.
I think, I don't remember if I had told you this before when we were emailing about setting this up, but Carol of the Bells came out a couple of years ago. It was an EP and I just love your version of that. And the trombone really surprises me in that because I'm not expecting that to come up. And it's just, it's snappy, it's peppy, it's cruising along, you're having a good time. And then boom, trombone solo. And it fits in perfectly. And that's just not something you're expecting in Carol of the Bells, but it works so well.
Thank you.
When you put out that EP, was that when you started maybe thinking a Christmas album might be in the works?
Yes, absolutely. It was all very premeditated. I was already writing the rest of it in my head, at least. I hadn't sat down in front of the Sibelius, you know, screen yet and put the notes on the paper. But yes, it was already kind of there in my head. And I had the band and we were ready to do it. And it was super fun. And, you know, my whole life, Christmas, my parents are music teachers, you know, Christmas time is the time when we're busy. It's when you got to put on a show, baby. And church is busy, you know, put on the pageant and do the production. And so we've always put the Christmas tree up in my family, like the week before Thanksgiving. Otherwise, we won't get it up because every weekend after that is rehearsal, tech week, whatever it is we're doing. So it was just natural that we have a Christmas album. And I really do hope to play it for years to come.
Last year was the what are you doing for New Year's Eve?
What are you doing New Year's Eve? Yeah.
And now the album's just out and you've collected these singles that you've released and you've added some new stuff. And it's such a great collection because it really does run the gamut of song styles and emotions from a very gospel-y Go Tell It on the Mountain to James Brown, Santa's Got a Brand New Bag.
Yes.
It's so fun. And as I was listening to this earlier today and I was thinking, you know, the band in the background, and not always in the background, but the band is, I don't want to say makes it, but they make it a lot of fun.
They do. If they don't come up to the fun, it'll feel wrong. But I really, you know, I moved to Austin in 2020 and as soon as I got here, I found, you know, all you got to find is one person. So I found one drummer through a friend, you know, through Instagram. And I reached out and was like, hey, I moved to town. Will you play with me? And who are your favorite bass players, piano players, guitar players. And when you have a drummer as picky as the one I play with here in Austin, you get the best people. So I'm very, very happy. And thank you for noticing.
Oh, certainly. You can't help but notice when you listen to this. I do have to ask you this, and I hope this doesn't, if you haven't thought about it, it doesn't put it in your head and make things difficult next time you're in the studio. But when you record a song like Silent Night or Oh Holy Night, I think of those songs as kind of like performing the national anthem at the World Series. Mm. It's a song everybody knows, but you've got to get it right or people are going to be mad.
I've sung the national anthem at a lot of baseball games and a lot of NFL games too. And it is like that. Don't worry. That's way more grave than Oh Holy Night and Silent Night. Because Oh Holy Night and Silent Night is about Jesus Christ who already forgave me. But Americans at a baseball game aren't that forgiving. So it's actually a whole lot easier.
One more thing about this album. There are a couple versions of Blue Christmas on here. And one of them is live with the Cincinnati Pops.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Fun fact, I was 7.5 months pregnant in that recording with the Cincinnati Pops, you know, it's special to me for a whole other reason. My dad's on the album. My son is like in there somewhere. wait a second. I was pregnant during the EP, during the whole Carol of Bells EP. All right. Forgot about that. it was 2 years ago that we recorded that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My whole family's in it. That happened because I do a lot of symphony. I've been very, very blessed to be able to take my original pop music, you know, my jazz stuff, to pops orchestras. I played with the Boston Pops and the Seattle Pops and Toledo, and I've played overseas with Geneva Camerata, and it's fun to take, you know, these trio songs or these guitar tunes with and blow them up with symphony. So I did that enough, and I got a call about a Christmas show finally. And I'm thinking, well, nothing says Christmas like strings, so why would I say no to that? And John Morris Russell, the conductor of the Cincinnati Pops, if I'm allowed to pick favorite conductors, he's so much fun, and he's so sweet, and he puts together a Christmas show every year, and I did it that year, and it was an excuse to take some of my not Christmas, I had all this not Christmas symphony material already, but I didn't have any Christmas material, and Blue Christmas was already out. And so I said, hey, let's get this arranged for symphony. And we did it. And they were, after the show, they were kind enough to, they're planning on perhaps releasing a lot of that show on their own album. And for Tradesies, they said, well, why don't you release one of ours on yours? And so thank you, Cincinnati Pops, for making that happen.
I hate to ask this after you've got this Christmas album just out. Mm-hmm. But is there the possibility of more Christmas music on the horizon for you?
Oh, yeah, there always is. As long as it's not Jingle Bell Rock or Santa Baby. I will never sing Santa Baby or Jingle Bell Rock. Everything else, you know, we'll talk about it.
So other than new Christmas music, what's coming up next for you?
Next year, my goal is to get my big band show done and ready. I mean, we the show is done. My goal is to make a big band album, actually. And so that'll be huge, you know, and feature 19 horn players. Well, sorry, 15 horn players and, you know, 4 rhythm section players. And that'll be fun. A lot of people, very different than a symphony. We did the show in September, and that was so wonderfully fun. And now all the arrangements are done, and now we just got to get in the studio and do that. And then simultaneously, my hope is to release another original record or a series of singles, which will be very much the opposite of the big band record, because we'll probably just have piano, bass, drums, guitar, and singers at most on that one. So it'll kind of be side A, side B for my next plans.
Very cool. What's the best way for people to keep up with you?
AubreyLogan.com is the hub that will take you to Instagram. There's little icons there for Facebook, for YouTube. That's the best way. I am reachable there, and I'm also very Googleable if you need the music from anything. So just Google Aubrey Logan Christmas and it'll come up on Amazon, iTunes, Spotify, Deezer, Napster, even anywhere.
And
I'm very findable.
I'll put a bunch of those links down in the show notes so everybody who's listening can just click away.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was so much fun talking to you. I'm going to really enjoy playing the new record this I don't know if people say record anymore.
I do. Recorded it.
Good. I'm going to really enjoy playing your record this season and adding it into the Sounds of Christmas library. And thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Ken. And if anybody wants a signed copy, they can find that too. They just go to AubreyLogan.com and they click store, and it takes them down the Elwick Road there.
And thank you so much for listening and for continuing to support the Sounds of Christmas station and podcast. I already told you how to listen to the station, and you're listening to this podcast, so my work here is just about done. All of our episodes are available on the Sounds of Christmas website. Just click the podcast tab. We also have a Linktree page so you can find us on your favorite streaming site, subscribe, and you'll never miss another episode. And I'll put links for that down in the show notes as well. If you have comments or suggestions on this episode, previous episodes, or the Sounds of Christmas station, feel free to reach out to me on social media or through the website. Thanks again, and may you always believe in Santa Claus.